What's up, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today is November 10th, 2018. And that's right. See, we're doing like two podcasts in 3 days here. I told you I'd get my shit together and get back with it. And not only that, this is not just going to be a half hour of diarrhea of the mouth for me. Unfortunately, I hate to inform you, but I have somebody on the line with me who I will introduce in a second as soon as I do a little bit of what I like to call housekeeping. And it goes like this. Man, I feel really relaxed, too. It's a Saturday. How you feel, Ryan? You feel good?
Feeling good, man.
All right. Please don't blind me with your enthusiasm.
Good to go.
I feel good. I think I feel pretty good. Anyways, up front, there's a 2-drink minimum. I just want to let people know that. It is a requirement. As a matter of fact, I just asked Ryan to make sure he had a cocktail ready. He informed me that he spent the entire day at IKEA. So I told him when he got back, he should have a drink before he gets on the podcast with me. And I'd like to invite you, the listener, to also partake in having a cocktail with us. After all, it is Saturday, and I know you work very hard. No, you don't, you degenerates. Anyways, number two is this is not financial advice. It's not legal advice. It's not advice to buy or sell any type of security. Ryan, nor I are, you don't hold any licenses, do you, Ryan?
I do not.
Yeah, me neither. Good. So we are not financial professionals, and having said that, you should not listen to anything that we say at all from this point forward. That's number two. Number three is that this podcast today is brought to you by my Patreons. Patreon is a service that allows you to make a recurring donation to the QTR podcast, as small or as much as you would like. I have a good group of solid individuals that I am extremely thankful for that have signed on to my Patreon. And help continue to support the podcast. Because listen, folks, if you're tired of listening to the same shit every day on the financial media, and you want to talk to some real fucking sharks, some real sharp people that the world doesn't know about, like my man Ryan Sellers that I got on the line right now, that's why we're here. And if you enjoy that, we're trying to put a little something together here with this podcast, and I very much appreciate your kindness and your generosity that comes through on Patreon. I do want to shout out real quick just a couple of my newest Patreons: Massimo Garrado, Frederick Schott, Drew Knowles, Shane Mitt, Billy Shear, Justin Kennedy. What's going on, brother? From Canada. The folks at Space Ventures Investors, Justin Toner, Scott Erickson, Matt Kiefer, Mihailo Haller, Aaron Kemp, Don Kelly. And also, too, want to shout out a couple of people that have been down with me for a while, like David Hansen. My name is Carl. I guess his name is Carl. I don't know his last name. I'm just going on a limb there, Ryan. You're going to see that type of intuition and quick thinking throughout this entire podcast. Ryan Dickovitsky, endthefed.org. We love those guys. We're on the same page as them. Franz Xavier Huber, Agnes Dobo, Mike, Peter Masso, Keith McCutcheon, Sarah Calaf, Dave Osten, Chris Bede, my fucking brother, been coming through forever. Just want to say thank you very much to you guys. And in keeping with the promise that I'm going to try to continue to keep, that is, I want to have the intros, the Patreon, and all that shit taken care of, you know, within a couple of minutes. The point is not to litter the podcast with shit other than content. Because I hate that, and I'm guessing Ryan hates that as well. He hasn't told me, but I feel like now, knowing him for 2 years, we have a deep spiritual bond, and I feel like I can speak for him on that. So the goal is to try and do less of that, but I do want to acknowledge my Patreons. And if you become a Patreon, you do get a little bit advance notice as to guests that are coming on. You get a chance to submit questions, and generally, I just like you a little bit more. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, in a industry full of shitheads and creeps and liars and assholes and crumb bums and dickweeds and just terrible people, one of my favorite people is on the line today. You know, there's guys like Ryan that just kind of sit under the surface. This dude is not on television. He's not, you know, all over the place. You probably don't even know his name. You may know him as @OpenOutcryer on Twitter. He did speak in Vegas with me over the last 2 years. And this is trying to keep with no bullshit, high quality content, this is the kind of guests I like having on. Not only is Ryan a buddy of mine, but He's also one of the sharpest dudes I've met. He is an ex-floor trader. I actually had the pleasure of sitting around for a whole day and trading with him last month. And he runs Open Outcryer. And if you don't know what Open Outcryer is, it was one of the original FinTwit names that really broke through. So probably back in like 2011 or 2010 when FinTwit was still kind of, or maybe it was 2012, I don't know, he can correct me, but when FinTwit was still becoming a thing and it wasn't as full-fledged as it was now and tweets weren't moving the market all the time, he was one of the originals to post options data when he saw flow and unusual chatter coming into names. And then he took that and he turned it into a service called Open Outcryer, which you can check out. I think it's openoutcryer.com. He'll correct me if I'm wrong. Where they now offer that for very low price. I think it's like $99 a month or something. But he's one of the dudes that got me onto Twitter when it came to finance. He was one of the first people that I put on push alerts years ago. And he's a great guy to have a beer with. So, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, without further ado, the one, the only, Ryan Sellers. What's going on, brother?
Not much, man. Cheers. Thanks for that. Thanks for that intro. It was very flattering.
I was a lengthy intro, wasn't it?
That was very flattering. I really, really appreciate that, bud.
There were two ways I could have gone with that. I could have tried to keep it short, or I could have tried to ham it up, and I felt like hamming today.
I got no problem with that. I'll take the compliments. Mm-hmm. So we were on, I think we didn't even get onto Twitter until 2014. So we were watching it kind of individually, watching it like through our own accounts. And then when we decided to contribute as Open Outcryer in 2014, so when we got started there.
Who were some of the people you first noticed on like FinTwit?
You know, it's weird because you start with the big names, and you start with Reuters and Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal, and then from there you start to find personalities and traders. Some of my favorite guys that I've found are like at Day Trade. The guy Steve Fetzer, he's really good. You can go down a couple of rabbit holes. You can go into the bio Twitter areas and find some guys that are really, you know, that'll take you deep into that realm. So you can find whatever sort of information you want when you curate your feed to all these different things. And I mean, there's just, people are just putting out great information to Twitter these days. It's as fast as a lot of expensive news wires, if you know who and what to look for.
Right. Yeah, and one of the things that like changed my game a long time ago, not only like you say, I'm following quality people, and especially people that are experts in areas that I am not an expert in. Like, I know fuck all about biotech, right? So I follow probably 10 or 15 biotech guys that I know they're either biojournalists or they're veterans of the industry. But putting people on push alerts was one of the things that really changed my game like 3 years ago. You were no longer waiting for people to show up in your feed or on TweetDeck, I think, which is even slower. And when somebody would come out with news, basically you're getting it almost as soon as it hits the wire.
Right. And I mean, and there's certain sort of people who make calls now where you have to follow them because they release their stuff on Twitter. So you got to follow, I mean, you got to follow a Citron, you got to follow a Muddy Waters, you got to follow a Spruce Point, you got to follow Icon sometimes. So post a random Twitter thing before he says it anywhere else. So there's lots of great information out there. People are using it as a great tool, and I hope they continue to because it's been really friggin' useful.
Icon makes me laugh, man, because every time he comes out with something, it's always like positioned under the guise of he's trying to help a company and help shareholders, and it's so blatant, some of the shit that he does, that you know he's just trying to make money. Like, I'm thinking specifically of what he did with, like, Amtrust when he bought a huge stake in that company, and then they had to go ahead and raise, I think, the price that they were going to take it private at. You know, I find it kind of funny how he puts on this facade of like, oh, I'm here to help shareholders. It's like, dude, you're here to make fucking money and nothing else. So his tweets are always like, read my letter for several pieces of concern I have about this.
Have you ever tried to read one of those letters?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, they're real rough reading.
Fuck no. I saw one of his I saw one of his sons on CNBC one time trying to talk about Netflix like 4 years ago, and he wasn't the most eloquent person in the world. I happen to believe that he wasn't Carl. If he wasn't Carl Icahn's son, I would have given him, I would have handicapped him at a 0% chance of getting on financial media.
Yeah, I mean, albeit I don't know who I am to judge for the altruistic nature of what we do sometimes.
Well,
we're just trying to make a buck at the same time.
Dude, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I just think, you know, it's funny. There's like a little bit of a polish that he puts on things that, you know, is just horse shit. So, anyways, much like the rest of the financial industry. I'm taking your silence as a 100% agreement.
That is a tacit agreement, my friend.
So, let's talk about Las Vegas, because Vegas is where we met for the first time 2 years ago at the Traders for a Cause conference. I haven't done any kind of recap on how Traders for a Cause went, and you were there this year. So, what'd you think?
I had a great time. I really enjoyed it. They put on a really good conference. There's good value add with the speakers there. The networking events, I always meet a couple people who I continue to keep in touch with. It puts so many faces with names and Twitter handles. That's just really nice for building and growing relationships, just like me and you. I mean, we were friendly on Twitter for a year or so before we realized we were both going to be there. And I was like, oh, great. I get to finally meet this person who I chat with, you know, a couple times a week. And so to connect all these dots is just always, it's fun, it's interesting, and you never know, you know, and you never know what to expect.
Yeah, people pretty much introduce themselves by their Twitter handles there.
Yeah, it's weird, because I felt like kind of a big dick doing that at first, like, hi, I'm Open Outcry, you feel like a moron saying that out loud, those words, but I'd go, hi, I'm Ryan Sellers, and then someone would just be like, they'd turn and look away, and be like, yeah, all right, cool, whatever, bud, see you later.
Yeah,
and then 2 minutes later, they'd come back to me and they'd be like, oh, you're Open Outcry, I wanted to ask you about this, this, and this, and it's weird, I don't know, just how that works.
Well, you're starting to put the face to the name a little bit more now, or the name to the Twitter handle, you know what I'm trying to say.
Right.
Now, after two years of presenting at this conference, people starting to know who you are, and it's like the day trade, like you mentioned, you follow him, you know, it was nice to meet mm-hmm. him in person. I think I met him 3 years ago when you weren't there, and then he was back again this year. I don't even know if he still goes, if he goes by his name. I'm not going to blow him up and say his name, but it was cool to meet him in person. I've followed him for a long time.
Yeah, definitely.
I will say he showed up in a pair of snazzy fucking Louis Vuitton gold-plated sneakers, or I don't even know what they were, loafers, the night of that. The night of the networking event at Beer Park. Did you see him?
Yeah, the man looked good. The man looked good.
Dude, he had at least $1,000 on his feet.
It was like Sanlucci the year before. The man looked good. Man took care of himself.
Yeah, Sanlucci took care of himself until about six Jamesons on the rocks, and then we wound up going to that club. And then, he was dressed fantastic. We'll just say that. I still got to get... I mean, Sanlucci owes me a lifetime of Jameson for the one drink I bought him, which I think costs upwards of $300 at that bar or whatever it was. But yeah, it was a really good event, man. It was the Beer Park for those... Well, I guess actually the weekend starts with this VIP event on Thursday night that is hosted at Tom... I forget his last name. You remember his last name, the guy that hosts the event?
Yeah, so I believe it's Tom Kelly.
Tom
I know
Kelly,
he's on the board,
right.
And then I think the other main guys are Nate and Zach and Scott, and I mean, just a big thank you to them. They put on a great event. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having us. I really enjoyed it. I mean, they did a great job. And yeah, go ahead. Where you started, the event at Tom's house is just the start of it, and that guy's house is something special, man.
His house is incredible. So this guy has a beautiful house in Las Vegas, and I guess because it doesn't rain in Vegas often, you can build half of your fucking house outside. I mean, half the guy's house is outside. You walk in like through a lobby, And then you walk, I guess, through like a koi pond or whatever, but it's all outdoors. I guess it's because they're in the desert that you can do that, right?
Yeah, I mean, that place was fantastic.
Yeah, it was a beautiful event. And then Rod Carew was there, which I thought he did a fantastic job and gave a very inspiring speech.
Yeah, just a very, very emotional speech about his story and his exposure to some rather sad events of cancer in his family. But just inspiring to hear firsthand, you know, stuff. And then all of the charities who got a chance to speak. It's a nice event. Like, the money goes to great causes. It's all stuff that, you know, you feel good about giving to. And on top of it, you know, you can get a lot out of it, you know. So all around, it was great.
Although I wasn't quite able to bid for the Tuscan villa vacation during the silent auction or whatever John Najarian called me out on. You remember that?
I do. He likes to throw some jabs your way, but both Najarians were there this year. They're really nice guys. They're very generous with their time. They go to everything. They talk to everybody. There's no pretense with them at all. It's just, Tyler Matheson was there. I had no opinion of him until meeting him, and couldn't have been a nicer guy.
Right.
I thought he handled the panels really well. He was quick on his feet. He asked good questions. He kept the conversations going well. I mean, the guy's a pro.
Yeah. You would never know from watching him on CNBC, because I feel like he gets these hits on kind of mundane information and, you know, just kind of, he's on it like 15, 30 seconds at a time, it feels like. Rarely do I see him hosting, I don't think, but I'm not sure. I don't watch a ton of CNBC. But with that being said, I thought he was an extremely nice guy to hang out with. He was very humble, and he had a great fucking sense of humor, and his wife was really cool. I was really impressed with him, and I was impressed with the Najarian brothers, too. I mean, this wasn't like they, you know, got a $250,000 speaking fee and came and walked in and spoke and left. I mean, they came for charity. And not only that, they didn't just do what they were asked to do, which was their speech and their panel. They came to all the events and they hung out and they went golfing. And, you know, funny thing, that morning before, so we went down on a Thursday, and that Friday, Ryan and I wound up sitting around trading together at the Cosmopolitan Hotel. But I went down to the sports book that morning to just kind of get situated and set up my laptop. And I saw John like across the hotel. I guess the guys had a golf outing on Friday. And I saw a bunch of the guys that were at the conference and John Najarian all kind of like walking out of the hotel with a bunch of beer and liquor on their way to the, and their, you know, golf shit on. I was like, I guess the guys are going golfing and drinking at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, good for them.
Good for them is right.
Who else? The host, Jill Malandrino, she was great this year.
Yeah, she was. She was really nice, too.
Yeah, very nice. Very, very knowledgeable. She went, all these people, it was just so nice that everyone was involved, and it wasn't just like a flyby, drop in, do your thing, and then leave. Everybody shows up to do their job, and then also to just kind of experience the event. And the generosity of people's time, I think I was most impressed with.
I think the cool thing is, because the kind of core group that shows up every year are all kind of tight with each other, and I guess, I don't know how they all know each other originally, but I know a lot of them go through Nate's Investors Underground service, and you know, they've known each other for years. They all kind of hang out together, which kind of is this fiber that ties together the whole weekend, you know. Everybody's all kind of in one group together all weekend, which really makes it a fun event and not one of those conferences that you go to and, you know, you show up and instantly you just look for the bar and you try to avoid everyone that's there. It's a really like inclusive, and it's a low key, it's not a financial conference. It's really like a party weekend, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I mean, for me, I found at least, you know, the speakers are varied. So there's people talking about things that I think the first year I was there 2 years ago was more, a little bit more of short activism. So there was kind of a thread that ran through a lot of the speakers there. And then this last year, there was a few more maybe traders, and they were, you know, talking about technical analysis and stuff like that. So they changed the themes a little bit each year, and there's always something to, there's always like a little kernel of knowledge to be gained, you know, a new strategy, a new idea, a new something, you know. So I've taken something away from it each year that I've gone and have implemented into my own trading. So, I mean, these are, half the speakers are legit traders. They're guys who are there pushing the buttons, making decisions. It's not just people talking about theoretical financial BS, or here's what a book says, or here's what I think I should, or here's what I did 20 years ago when I, you know, made a name for myself. These people are doing it.
Yeah, and in terms of kind of getting a little bit of a slice of the financial world underground, it's a good place to do that too, because it's not one of these stuffy kind of everybody wears a suit, you know, environments. It's really not. It's, like I said, it's a great group of people that all stick together, but the contributors and the speakers and the hosts are people that really have it. They're really fucking sharp people. I mean, they're people like you. They're people like, you know, Sam. They're people like Maj. You know, people that are really just generally sharp people that have been working strategies or have been trading on their own successfully for years, but just kind of stay under the surface, either because they want it to be like that or because the mainstream hasn't really noticed them yet. But you get like far more bang for your buck going to an event like Traders for a Cause and watching those presentations than you would, you know, going to like the Sohn conference, in my opinion.
You don't like to be piggybacking hedge funds trades weeks after they put them on?
You know, the fucking Sohn conference is like, if you took everybody I've met my entire life that I've tried to avoid and put them all into one room and then charge me $5,000 to go there and hang out with them. I mean, it's just like, it's insane, because the second somebody fucking says anything regarding a ticker symbol, the stock has already moved. Okay, like,
yeah.
At first, I will admit, the first Sohn conference I went to, I was like, wow, it's really cool. I'm going to be around all these major hedge fund managers, you know, the guys that I see in the business page, the guys that I see on TV. And then you meet them and you get there and you're like, these guys suck. Like, this isn't somebody I would want to have a beer with. You know, many of them are brilliant people, but a lot of them don't have any social or emotional intelligence, and they're like awkward to speak to and nervous and weird and like, I don't really know. And then, you know, I felt like the Sohn conference. Have you ever been to the Sohn conference?
I have not, though.
Okay, I feel like...
I don't know if they're going to invite you back again anytime.
Well, that's all right. Well, look, I'm just trying to be honest here, all right? First off, the first thing I noticed when I went in is it was very clicky, right? So, like, you could see all the Italian guys were hanging together. All the guys from Connecticut were hanging together. All the Orthodox Jewish guys were hanging together. It just felt, like, very clicky. Like, you could point to a group of people and be like, you know, just as I'm sure it was on the trading floor, right? I remember watching that Open Outcry. I think it was either the PBS documentary or the Floored movie, where the guy says the floor was very clicky. Was it like that on the trading floor?
Oh, I mean, a little bit, but it's more everybody, it's more who hires people. So everybody hires people they're familiar with, which tends to be people of similar backgrounds. And then you hang out with your group, you know, those are your guys.
Yeah.
So it kind of just ended up being that.
Yeah, well, the first impression I got from Sohn was very much, like, clicky. Like, I didn't really know kind of where to go or where to sit or who to talk to. I was like, you know. And then you go and you finally meet some of these people. And, you know, they're brilliant investors and, you know, a million times smarter than I'll ever be when it comes to accounting and, you know,
right,
forensic accounting, right, and proxy battles and all of the esoteric shit that you need to be engrossed in order to be an activist hedge fund manager, but you just get the feeling that not a lot of them have ever bonged a beer before. And that's really what I look for in a person to speak to. it helps if you're brilliant, but I want to be able to know that you're going to be able to take any bottle down from behind the bar at any given time and do a shot from it and not panic or cry or call your mother. I mean, some of these guys were worth tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars, and they looked like their mother was still packing their fucking bologna sandwich to take to work with them in the morning. That was the impression I got.
Perhaps.
I'll take your silence as you don't want to offend anybody. But
I don't really want to offend anybody. I've never been. Like, I don't want to speak out of, you know, out of turn.
Oh, all right.
On this issue. But yeah, so I don't know. Let me ask you a question. How did you get from, you always say you're slinging beers 8 years ago, to getting into finance?
Oh, that's an interesting question.
What lit the fire for you?
Well, I was a shareholder in a company. So I had, like, I knew about the stock market since I was 17 or 18 years old, and I was always interested in it and had, you know, basically lost money learning stocks, options, Forex, everything. I was just a very unsuccessful and terrible investor, and that's how I learned. I mean, I learned about options by going into my local Scottrade branch when I was like 23 and having some boner with acne try and explain options to me. Like, it was a very organic learning experience from my end, and mm-hmm. It was something I was just doing on the side. I was going to graduate school and I was living in South Philly. I wound up bartending at this bar called McGillin's that I loved, which was in Center City, Philadelphia. And I worked there for like 5 years. And during the course of my employment there, I became a stockholder in a company that I was really passionate about that, of course, wound up going to zero. But throughout the course of that, I met somebody from the company who came into my bar one night, and we were talking about the company. It enticed me enough to take a look at it. I did a lot of research on it, a year, year and a half's worth of research. Became a stockholder, and then the company wound up getting sued by the SEC for misstating an asset that it had on its books, some media credits. And they had a very small team. I think they had an accounting department of like one or two at the time. It was a real kind of grassroots campaign for this company. But it was a legit company that had a legitimate technology that I really was excited about. So I wound up going to work for them. They were up in Niagara Falls, New York. Got the CEO's cell phone number one day after being a stockholder for like a year, year and a half. And after they got sued by the SEC, you know, called the CEO because I wasn't really happy with how their IR was handling the response to the SEC lawsuit. And I just called the CEO and told him and said, you know, let me come work IR for you. And that was it, man. I went up, I met with him, interviewed with him, and then a couple months later wound up going to work for him and did that for 2.5 years. So that took what little knowledge of the financial markets I had and really helped bolster it significantly because I was working. First off, it was the first IR program internally that the company had ever had. So I was implementing it from the ground up. And what are you doing? I mean, when you're the director of IR, you're working on SEC filings, you're speaking to securities lawyers, you're working with the CFO, you're working with the CEO. So it's really a quick way to get a deep dive into, you know, what's appropriate and what isn't appropriate in the world of public disclosure. And then, you know, I started writing for Seeking Alpha under the Quote the Raven name when I was up there, basically just to make extra money for beer. And if you go read my old stuff on Seeking Alpha, I mean, it's just terrible, terrible stuff. I mean, it's clear that I have no idea what I'm talking about. But then I've just kind of been learning naturally over the last, you know, few years. While I was up there, I read one of Geo Investing's reports on Longway Petroleum at the time, which was a China-based petroleum company that said it was doing a bunch of business, and it turned out the fucking gates weren't even open, and the rail spur had, you know, weeds growing over it, and total fraud. I read their due diligence report on that, and I was really impressed by it. So when the company was doing poorly and I had to leave, mainly because, you know, we got into a cash crunch, I wound up looking up GeoInvesting when I got home and asking them if they needed a writer or needed an analyst. Interviewed with them, and I've been there for the last, 5 years. And doing, Quote the Raven on the side.
Very done.
What do you think?
I like it. I like it. Interesting way to get to this point. I like the story.
What I would like is I would like you to tell the investing public and listeners of the podcast about the world's most miserable bartender that we had the morning that we were trading together.
So this was the Friday morning of the Vegas conference, and Chris and I are in the Cosmopolitan Sportsbook with trying to trade on the world's worst Wi-Fi. So just dabbling, but watching the markets, doing our best. And we went up to the, it was about, I think, 2 p.m., and we go up to the bar for, I think I wanted a Bloody Mary, and I was going to get you a Bloody Mary. And there was maybe two other people at the bar, and this guy just couldn't believe that we asked him to make us a drink. Doing nothing but cleaning bottles there by himself. Couldn't have been more bothered by our requests for two Bloody Marys at 2 p.m. on a Friday in Las Vegas.
Yeah, it's kind of wild when you think about, when I think about the fact that Las Vegas is supposed to be like the pinnacle of hospitality in the United States, right? There is no other city in the world that is focused on hospitality the way Vegas is. And then to go up there and ask this guy for two Bloody Marys, all right? The guy makes a fucking face like he's passing a kidney stone out of his ass. I mean, it was a fascinating experiment. I don't know what was, maybe he was just having a bad day. But I told you that
maybe,
morning.
He just started a shift, and he was not, so, I don't know, something wasn't right with that guy's world that day.
He wasn't. He didn't just start a shift, because I got a ginger ale from him earlier. He'd been there for hours. But it started that. Am I getting too worked up? finish his shift.
His reaction was great, but yours was just as good. Genuinely flabbergasted at the
attitude. Well, I was a little annoyed because when we went downstairs, so that morning before you came down to the sports book, I was basically just trying to find a spot to sit and chill with my laptop because it was a Friday and the market was open and, we were kind of on vacation, but I still wanted to get some work done, and Maj was there and I knew he would want to get some work done too. So when I went down to the sports book, which is basically, for those listening, it's, if you've never been to a sports book at a casino, it's a room where they have about, 50 televisions, and all of them are usually on different sporting events on a Saturday or on a Sunday. But because this was a Friday and there was nothing going on during the day, all the TVs were just on ESPN or whatever, and they were replaying highlights. So I found a little area in the corner of the room where I thought it would be cool to set up my laptop, and I went up to the desk to ask the guy if he could put one of the televisions on CNBC. And he told me no. He was like, I went up and asked him like first thing that morning. I was like, excuse me, would you mind putting one of these TVs maybe down here in the corner on CNBC? And he's like, I can't do nothing until my boss gets here. And I was like, well, what time is your boss going to get here? By the way, I can see the fucking remote controls right there on the desk next to you. All right, so I'm pretty sure you're lying to me to begin with, but I was like, what time's your boss get here? He's like, you're not going to be here for another hour. I'm like, fuck. So eventually went back once somebody else was sitting with him. Also looked annoyed when I asked him. I was like, hey, would you mind turning on CNBC? He's like, what do you want that on for? I'm like, I don't know. It's the stock market channel. It's kind of like gambling, It's not like the two are completely foreign to one another.
But, I mean, it was the middle of the day on a Friday. There was no games going on. Every commercial was just playing, like, token ESPN, daytime, whatever. There's no reason for this to be an issue. It should have just been like, oh, yes, sir, you're the only customer sitting here watching a television, so I should probably take care of it.
There was no one there. There was nobody in the sports book. And instead of just being like, yeah, no problem, both of them acted like I asked them to shoulder the weight of the world. And then the Bloody Mary was just a nice little coda on that. I asked the guy for a pint glass, and he made a an interesting face. And look, it's very simple, all right, folks? If you don't want to fucking serve drinks for a living, don't be a bartender, all right? That's it. You don't want to change tires, don't be a mechanic. I'm not forcing you to be here. I got to ask for a pint glass, and the guy's going to be like, you know, making sighing noises and groans and grunts. But we had a good day that Friday, didn't we?
No, yeah, that was fun.
What did we do Friday night?
So Friday night we went to dinner with Maj, and then we went to Beer Park. It was Friday night.
Right,
Beer Park. The meet and greet, kind of like cocktail hour.
And that's always cool at that place.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fun place. It's right on the strip. It's outside. You can just stand there and people watch.
And you have the Bellagio fountains right across the street.
Yeah, Bellagio fountains right across the street. I mean, our hotel was like right across the street. That location was killer. So that was Friday night. Saturday morning is the major part of the conference. Kind of the all day, everyone gives their speech day. Then I don't know about you, but like after the conference, I always feel like I'm pretty busy because then there's like drinks after the conference and dinner after the conference and then the other meet and greet at the other place at Chayo or whatever. So like Saturday is a long day, but it's fun. I mean, keeps you busy, but it's good.
It is. There's a lot of events planned on Saturday, and I unfortunately missed your talk. What did you talk about this year?
I talked about the worst trading day I ever had.
Oh, let's hear that story right now.
All right. So I had, this is still fresh, fairly fresh. It was the beginning of October.
This year?
This year, beginning of October. I literally had a speech ready to go.
What was it, like 5 days before the conference?
5 days before the conference. So I had a speech ready to go. I was going to talk all about options and trading options and my favorite strategies and why I trade the way I trade and describe all of this in grand detail with a nice PowerPoint presentation and everything. And then the Friday before the conference, I literally had the worst trading day I ever had. It was just gut-wrenching. I was beside myself. I was wrecked. I was miserable. I was angry. I was all those things. And I think, so this was on a Friday. Friday is, every Friday is an expiration now for us options traders. And I was a monster all weekend. I was just so upset. And on Sunday night, I think I finally started to come around to the rational way to move forward and what to do. When you have a bad day, you want to get back in there. At least I do. If I have a bad day, I want to get back in there the next day and I want to fix it. I want to make it better. I want to wash the taste out of my mouth. But so when it happens on a Friday, you kind of got to stew a little bit.
Yeah, that sucks. You got to
just kind of own it. And so there's nothing you can do about it. which can be a good or a bad thing depending on your reaction to it. So we don't want to. The ideal trader takes all their emotions out of it, but every single person is a human, so it's almost impossible to completely remove your emotions for it. So on this Friday, every trade I made was a loser, and I was doing everything wrong. I was chasing trades. I didn't follow my stops. I was cost averaging into trades. I was revenge trading. I was just, it was garbage. Fucking pure, just amateur hour. But the messed up thing about it was like, I think the reason that I had such a bad day and got so out of my own head was that the week before on a Friday, I thought I should have had a career day. I thought it was one of those days where I should have made just, six figures without even batting an eyelash.
Right.
And I And I didn't, and I was, I think I was chasing, it was almost like
you
I was
were
chasing
expecting profit. To do it the next Friday.
Right. I was expecting a similar situation to happen.
That's dangerous.
And in doing that and not thinking about good trades and smart decisions, I just wanted to make money. I wanted every trade to be a huge winner. And so I was swinging at things too big. I wasn't getting away when they were going against me. And I mean, it was a real harsh lesson. You know, you're never above the market. You're never, anyone can get smoked on any given day if you don't follow the rules.
And that's a dangerous dangerous kind of feeling that you're setting up, which is, you know, because I think as traders, we've all felt that way, right? We've all had a day where, for me, one of the big things was when Whole Foods got bought out, right? I had been saying for such a long time Whole Foods was going to get bought out. I was adamant about it. I had a weekly options position in the calls on almost, I would say probably, Ryan, for the year leading up to the buyout. And when it got bought out, I didn't have a position. And when shit like that happens, it just fucking torments you and it puts you into a tailspin that leads into the type of day that you're talking about.
Right. Right. So I think, this was one of the situations where the weekend was a good thing because it allowed me to regroup a little bit, get my mind right, and kind of figure out what went wrong and how to not do it again. And so on Sunday night when I posted a handful of tweets that I turned into this speech, kind of just talking about my situation, where my head was at. And I said that it was, for me, I didn't need to get into on Monday to make money. I needed to get back in there just to get back to being me. Just to get back to being, you know, the same disciplined grinding trader that I've been for, you know, 14 years basically. Is how long I've been trading electronically. So to know that that's who I am and not this, you know, this idiot who just chases everything and doesn't follow his own rules that have been there for years, you know, it doesn't take much for you to let things get away from yourself. So to kind of put the framework back in place that got me to where I am, as opposed to this thing I was chasing, this ghost I was chasing that is just a recipe for disaster.
Yeah, and the shit that you tell yourself when you get like that, when you get, I don't know what you call it, but it's like a mania almost, you know, and you start making excuses for, you know, breaking your rules and for trading in ways that you shouldn't. I think it's happened to everybody, man. Everybody that's, a full-time trader has experienced to some degree an episode like that. Was there something from the Friday when you fucking beefed it that you remember? Was there, you know, what were a couple of the trades that you put on that were just totally irresponsible? If you don't mind me asking.
Do you want the good Friday or the bad Friday?
Well, tell me about both.
All right. So the good Friday, this was the day. So this was the day after Musk had the SEC charges.
Okay.
So those came out Thursday, like after, right on the bell.
Yep.
It was SEC charges Elon Musk, and then all that happened. It was like 3:01 on the dot. It was right after the, you know. So I
remember your tweet too that day saying, "Why couldn't this happen when the options market were open?" I remember that.
Yeah. So that Friday was still kind of the fallout of Tesla. Then there was really big sort of binary trade with Intel and AMD. That had to do with Intel was gonna put a whole bunch of more money into their chip making process. Intel went up, AMD went down. It was like nickel options were running to dollars left and right. It was crazy. You could have put anything on and it was a winner. And then on top of it, Facebook had a data security issue, which was the same kind of thing. You could have bought nickels that went to dollars, and it's just, that's like the ideal setup for an options trader.
Right.
Those is when
Fridays.
Stuff moves on a Friday. Yep. Yeah, and you can just pick up stuff for less, you know, a dime or less, and have it run up to and through a strike. I mean, those are the days I live for. So I make good money, but I didn't make what I thought I should have made. You know, you kind of sit there and stew, and you're like, if you if you would have told me on that Friday morning that, hey, you're going to make whatever, 10 grand, you'd be like, oh, yeah, that's great, that's awesome. But then at the end of the day, you're like, man, why didn't I make 100 grand?
Right. You start thinking if I had put my whole account into it, I could have retired today.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not even the trades that you didn't put on. It's just your, you know, your exits, and you're just kind of, it was one of those days where it was just, it felt like I should have done better. So that was the good, Friday that I was chasing. And the bad Friday, the only one I honestly remember is I definitely traded some Tilray calls. This was after most of the mania.
Ew.
When it was coming down. And I was just, I bought them on the open for what was supposed to be a scalp trade. So because of all the volatility in Tilray, this thing could gap up, what, $10, $20, $30. And the options markets on these things open up $2, $3 wide.
Right.
So all I'm trying to do is sit on the bid and get filled and scalp it inside there for 50 cents a dollar. And, I mean, that's a good scalp for 10 seconds of work.
Right.
If you're disciplined and you're smart and you just hit your ins and outs. But I got hit on something on the open. I didn't scalp out of it. I didn't get hit at my prices, and I never took it off on the way down. Instead of taking it off, I just bought more, a dollar lower, more, a dollar lower. And at that point, I mean, that was the end of it. It never came back. And I mean, it's Bush League. I know that's not me. That's not what I do. The moment you put that second price into cost average, that should be your out.
Right. Yeah.
That's the moment you should be done with the trade. If you're thinking, oh, well, I'm going to get a better price, and it's going to, nope, shut up, get out of the trade, and then reassess. If you want to put the trade back on after that, totally fine. But do it with a clear head.
Yeah, I asked the Nigerians, you know, because I know that they're options traders also, too. You know, if they had one kind of like basic rule to abide by, and I'm wondering if you do the same thing. What one of them told me was, you know, we take off all losers after they lose 50%. You know, in the options market, mm-hmm. that's still considered a success. If you get 50%, it's like surrendering in blackjack. Like,
yeah.
It's a loss, but you take it. Because, you know, options very easily and very often just go to zero. So they said they always do that. And then on a double, they always take off half. And then, you know, essentially that covers their cost basis and lets the rest ride. Do you have, like, you have a hard and fast kind of basic rule like that you play by?
I did not, but that's a good starting point. I definitely took that to heart a little bit myself. A lot of the stuff I'm doing, like, I don't keep stuff. I typically am not in trades long enough for it to go against me 50%. And if I am, I knew I was going to ride it to zero from the get go. So that's a different trade. These are, you know, that's a lotto trade. If I would have followed that on this Tilray trade, I would have saved myself and my day a lot of money. Absolutely.
Yeah. So that was the big one.
So that was the big one. And then after that, it was chasing everything and just kind of out of my head from there.
Well, it's crazy because we hung out the whole trip and you never mentioned it. I mean, I didn't hear you say it in your speech. I thought that you were after me and not before me. So I didn't get to see your talk, unfortunately. But you never mentioned it through the whole trip.
Well, I mean, what are you going to maybe harp on it all weekend?
Yeah. get drunk and start hanging off of me. Hey, man, fucked up on Friday. I got to tell you. It's funny because...
No, I mean...
Go ahead.
In general, it's not something that I typically... I don't talk about trading wins and losses a lot. I think the best, if you're going to be someone who posts things about the market, if you're going to talk about trading wins and losses, you literally have to do it every day, all the time.
Right. That's the only way to do it. And it's kind of precedent.
Right. So to go and say, I made a ton of money today, blah, 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 I'm the greatest, seems disingenuous to me. You don't say you lost a bunch of money. So on the flip side, I'm the idiot who only says, oh, I had a really shitty day, because that's the only thing that I think can help people, like saying, hey, everybody has shitty days. Let's figure it out. And I mean, on top of it, my trade that I made money on is someone else's loser. And to go out there and to say, hey, I'm smart and, you know, and did this great trade, you're kind of walking over another man's grave. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that's the market. You can't be afraid of that. I mean, that's...
It is. But there's no reason... If you want to talk about...
It's a zero-sum game, trade, right?
Yeah, but if you want to talk about the strategy of a trade or the idea of a trade or why... The particulars of why it is, and that's fine, but it's much different than just talking about profits and losses. You know, the mechanics of a trade is a good conversation to have, but talking about dollars and cents, I don't think it does much for anybody.
Unless you want to post your entire fucking P&L every day.
Every day.
And so we can see every little shit move in and out of some crap that you would be embarrassed to tell people that you were trading. Like, I have many of those. You know what I mean? Like, how do you explain to somebody that you're, you know, making a trade on some soybean ETF with 10 minutes left before the options expire on a Friday? Like, how do you justify that to somebody? Like, yeah, this made a lot of sense at the time, you know, but one of the interesting things that you said that really resonated is, man, if you fuck up on a Monday or a Tuesday or a Wednesday, you come in the next day. But if you fuck up on a Friday, man, that you know, when that bell goes off at the end of the day and the first thing you think to yourself is, so when's the market open back up again? And the answer is 48 hours. Like, you need to sit in it. And sometimes if you do well on a Friday, it's an incredible weekend, you know, and you feel great and you enjoy the rest. But if you fuck things up on a Friday, you got to stare it right in the face for 48 hours.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And there's a real kind of psychological piece to being a trader that I don't think you get until you've just experienced it for a long time. And I think even then it's difficult. But you remember when you first started trading, you know, what the swings felt like to you?
I mean, so I learned very early on that I don't like the swings. I don't like the big ups and the big downs. I don't like I like to have consistent profits. I like to have consistent, comfortable days, and that's how I've always handled risk. That's always how I've always handled my trading. I want to be green every day, you know. So when you started out, it was make $300 a day, make $300 a day, then make $500 a day, make $500 a day, you know, and to try and build it that way. And I very rarely had the big drawdown days. I still did, but once, maybe twice a year, not once or twice a month. You know, I'm not, my P&L is a lot more of a very slow, gradual arrow going up than a bouncy line going all over the place. That's just me personally. I've never enjoyed the risk of the big ups, big downs. I want to be more consistent. So that's how I fit my trading style, and that's how I trade, because that fits my personality. Now, there's guys that I trade with where they have much better days than I do, but they also have much more red days than I do. So that's something that every trader's got to figure out for themselves. And it's, over the long term, it could be, I don't know, you know, they could both be just as right as the other person's. I've been trying to grow my good days better, and that's led to more red days for me. So I've got to learn and grow and readjust on the fly, and that's constantly what you have to do as a trader, is you're constantly tweaking, you're constantly learning, and, you know, if you want to have bigger up days, you have to take a little bit more risk. Okay, so how do you balance that out? You still got to be disciplined. You know, you still got to have your stops, and you got to be disciplined, because when you're putting on more risk, you got to be diligent with the downside. You can't mess it up, because you're not screwing up 1 week anymore. You're screwing up 1 month. You're screwing up three months, 6 months. That's disaster.
Yeah. Now, is your portfolio mostly, like, how much your portfolio goes back to cash at the end of the day? Like, what I mean, imagine you don't have some enormous long book where you're carrying, you know, 200 positions. I imagine you're mostly cash most of the time, and then you're just ducking in and out on things, and maybe occasionally you carry something for a week or a month. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's pretty accurate. I'm almost 99% day trading. Occasionally I swing, and occasionally I spread stuff when we see opportunities in unusual options or volatility spikes that don't make sense. Sometimes the skew gets out of whack, and you can put spreads on for next to nothing, which is a no-brainer trade to do in the options market. So I put on stuff like that. If I am, a lot of times when I'm carrying positions, it's because I've been stubborn about it and stupid about it, and I'm not going to sell something for a dime because I'm just stubborn, and I probably end up selling it for a nickel anyway. So it's just stubbornness at that point. Most of my trades is active day trading in and out, and that's where I'm best.
Do you feel reborn on Saturdays when you open up the account and all the expired options are finally out of it? Because I do.
Oh, yeah. It's cathartic. It's absolutely cathartic. You're just like, ah, no, I don't have to check anything, no stress, the stupid nagging position reminding me of how stubborn I am. Yeah. Freedom.
It's a wild feeling to just finally get all the shit out of your portfolio. Because if you're an options trader, you know, a lot of times you're left with many a week's worth of expiring positions, which can be, you know, tens or hundreds of positions that either they were parts of a spread or they were parts of a straddle or parts of a strangle or just trades gone wrong or whatever. But if you're trading options, especially in small size, relatively consistently, you got to look at all that shit in your portfolio until Saturday morning when they finally take it all out.
Yeah, and because I like to trade up to and around expiration Friday as well. So I'm looking at the high flying stocks like Amazon or Apple that are whipping around strikes or had the opportunity to whip through a strike.
Right.
So a lot of times I'm taking these cheap options just for a flyer, and I'll sit on them in the last hour just to trade stock against them. But you got to know when to exercise. You got to know not to exercise. You got to know if you're going to get assigned on anything. So you got to be diligent when you're trading options into and across expiration as well.
That's something I think every trader learns by having some position that's 1 cent in the money wind up being, you know, exercised in their portfolio. I mean, that happened the first time that happened to me. You know, my account was extremely small. I mean, it still is extremely small, but it was extremely smaller. And I remember I woke up on like a Saturday or Sunday morning, you know, and I was in like a $4 million margin call. I was like, oh, I didn't really panic because I was like, good luck trying to get $4 million from me, assholes. You know, like, you can have the bumper off of my Honda Accord if you'd like. But you know, until that Monday when you can finally trade pre-market and start to unload some of the stuff, you know, it's a wild feeling. Has that ever happened to you?
It has happened once or twice, and what's amazing about that is it's some trick of math, but somehow 90% of the time it goes against you.
Oh, yeah, I know.
I don't know how that's possible, but you never have the error in your favor.
No, on those trades. That never happens.
Yeah.
It's like,
that's just the nature of trading.
Well, and when you see that exercise position in your portfolio on a Saturday, you spend the whole fucking weekend thinking about it. You're like, all right, I'm long 50,000 shares of the SPY somehow. You know, what happens if somebody fucking launches a nuclear missile tomorrow? You know, like on a Sunday, I'm going to wake up Monday in a billion-dollar margin call.
Or by Monday morning, you become an expert in that company, even though you can't do anything about it until the stock starts trading anyway. You've researched every way that you might get screwed on this trade or it might work out for you.
Right.
Not that you can do anything about it, but that's just where your mind goes.
Yep. That's so funny. Is there a specific example where that happened?
No, honestly, it hasn't happened to me for a long time. I've been fairly good about closing out and keeping an eye on my positions in that nature. This probably hasn't been for, 10 years. It's been a long time.
Yeah, well, I wish I could say the same. But anyways, it is kind of funny, though. You know, you wind up trading options in a toilet manufacturer or something, and then all of a sudden you wake up Saturday morning and you own 10,000 shares of it or 100,000 shares of it. Hey, you spend most of your Saturday and your Sunday researching various toilets and the porcelain industry, the OEMs that are involved, how they're doing, you know, geopolitical tensions in the Ukraine where they're making parts of the toilet.
where do they source their porcelain from?
Exactly.
absurd nonsense searches that you can't do anything about.
Only Monday morning when that first, you know, second of pre-market trading starts,
and you have to exit a position that's like half the daily volume in the pre-market session. I've definitely lost some money doing that, like having something.
Yeah, and then you can exit your position so it can go up right on the open or later in the day.
Oh, yeah, you usually get that nice spike on the open.
Yeah, welcome to trading.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then what did you do? Did you stay Sunday or no for the conference?
I did stay Sunday. Sunday was kind of the breakout sessions. So I was in a small, that's where everybody can go to a separate room, and it's kind of like a choose your own adventure kind of thing.
Yeah, there's a lot of those in Las Vegas.
So I think I was sitting on a panel with Jay Mintzmyer of Investor's Edge and Michael Stapleton, and we just kind of, we had a group of guys come in and we talked about our background in trading, and they asked us some stuff about how we approach trading. And it's very conversational. It's a very easy way to go up and an informal way to just ask whatever question you have about, you know, basically any of the speakers that were there. So it's a nice opportunity to get, it's almost like one-on-one time because there's enough room for anybody to get a question at that point.
Yeah, I thought Jay Mintzmyer was an extremely personable, likable person. I had read his stuff on Seeking Alpha for like forever ago, and he just came up to me at Tom's house on Thursday, you know, like really bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and big smile, and says, "Hey, Chris, how you doing? I'm Jay Mintzmyer. I read all your stuff on Seeking Alpha all the time. It's fucking great to meet you." I'm like, shit, hey, what's going on?
He was super nice. I think I already fired him a couple questions about shippers I had, and he was answered them right away. So that's kind of the nice opportunity for me, is I can find someone who knows a lot more than me about a field or a topic or whatever, and now I have a source of information or a person to bounce ideas off of, and no one's ever not replied to anything I've ever asked of them, and so it's been very beneficial.
Yeah, that's like his expertise, right? He's into dry bulk.
Yep, absolutely.
I think maybe he was writing about dry ships way back in the day, way, way back in the day. And that's where I first heard of him or whatever. But super nice guy. And
definitely.
It was really a pleasure to meet him. So let me ask you a question, Ryan. What are you thinking about the state of the market right now and the volatility? Because, listen, you were on podcast number 2, which happened in February of this year. Glad that you're back, but fuck, it's been way too long. It's been like 9 months. And in that 9 months, things have gotten a little bit shakier, even just most recently. What do you think's going on? And what do you think, what options does it, here's a better question. What options does the Federal Reserve have if we start to see a 15% move back in stocks over the next, you know, 6 months?
I mean, this is not my wheelhouse. This is not my area of expertise. I am a day trader looking for opportunities intraday on stuff that's spiking. So my 2 cents might not really be on any sort of expert level. But I'll tell you from what I'm seeing in a day trading environment is the market got spooked again, but it wasn't pure terror. I don't even think it was quite as bad as the February downturn we had. I think that the election and the earnings that we just had from most of the big companies was a big part of that. And now I think for a little while, we're going to go back to business as usual. People got some of these big unknowns out of the way. So I think for the end of this year, people will shake it off and be fine. And I think next year is where we need to really focus on what's going to happen next.
Why? What do you think is going to happen next year?
I just think that there's new storylines that need to form. I think all of the things we were unsure about, I think the next unknown is what's going to happen with China and the trade war. It just seemed like Trump was posturing about getting stuff done. Is he going to fix anything at G20? Will there be any sort of resolution there, or are we just going to continue the same thing? And so that's the next big event that I'm looking for. Anytime something happens with Trump and China trade, the first stocks I go to is like a Alibaba or a Baidu.
Right.
And these guys like this, you know, so that's how I sort of attempt to trade these large macro themes, is I look for the stocks that matter most within them. So for me, it's an easy one is you can go to VXX, and that's kind of, or the spiders. The spiders are kind of big and scary because they're so expensive. There's so many strikes and expirations now. It's just nonsense. So I like the VXX. Or if I can find a stock-specific theme within the macro theme, so anything China-related, Baba and Baidu are my first two go-tos. That's kind of where I focus my attention.
Yeah, I think that's probably a very, pragmatic way to do it as a day trader. Not to try to guess where everything's going, but to look for themes within a theme. Certainly, I think that the Fed is in a precarious position. I think the dynamic between the president and the Federal Reserve and, you know, where the economy is at now, where pretty much everything is either overheating or on the verge of overheating, at least when it comes to different types of debt that are outstanding, I think it could be a really interesting year going forward. And I wonder where we're going to be in a year. I wonder if we're going to be with interest rates lower again a year from now, which I think is like a distinct possibility.
Yeah, Powell's next move is another big one too, definitely. The showdown between Powell and Trump and how that plays out.
Right, and like I was saying on a past podcast, I was saying, because whoever I was talking to was saying, oh, the Fed's independent. And it's like, look, Jerome Powell goes home and puts on the TV at the end of the day just like everybody else. He reads the news just like everybody else. I mean, you can't tell me that he's not at least in some very small percentage getting a little bit of pressure from the president's message, right?
Sure, but what is his reaction to that pressure? Is it to dig in and get stubborn and do what he thinks is right, or is it to bow to the pressure and, you know, and sort of back off on some levels? I can't speak to his reaction to that. When he's seeing and feeling it, I agree with you, but his reaction, I can't speak to.
But I feel like the option of going in and bowing to the president's pressure, I feel like would be catastrophic, not only for confidence in the Fed, but just for the economy in general. On the other hand, I think that at some point he's going to reach an impasse where there will be a fever pitch coming from not only the president, but also, you know, the general populace of the country. I think if things kind of, you know, if the market pulls back another 15% from here, and if you think about what just happened when the market pulled back 10%, if it pulls back another 15% from here, I mean, the drum is going to be beating very loudly in favor of the Fed doing something. Even as fucking ridiculous as a policy as that is, and we should never even be in this situation where we're basically using the Fed as a crutch, which I just think is, I think it's horrifying. I think it is a tremendous moral hazard. So we shouldn't even be here to begin with, but I think there will come a point where the public kind of outrage and the public and the president will reach a fever pitch at points where I think Powell's going to be put to a decision. I think maybe even he would step down if that's possible, because I just
What's the mechanism is the public gets upset because the market goes down and Trump blames the Fed, and you think that's what will influence the Fed to make an action?
Well, I think between that and I think the Fed is already conditioned to just base their policy in general on how the stock market's doing. So that's my foundation that I'm laying down. So even just based on that foundation, I don't think it's ridiculous. Then you have the president who's harping on these things. I think if things got a little bit worse, then you would have not only the president, you'd probably have some other lawmakers, you know, these people that have no clue how the economy works and have no clue about finance, grandstanding in front of Congress, you know, yapping and basically bringing the Federal Reserve into it. And then I think you would have a certain degree of complaining and hemming and hawing from the public, too. I mean, look, say you're Jerome Powell and you're faced with the decision of, you know, having to either resign or bow to the president's pressure. What do you do?
I mean, it's just when you look at historical interest rates and you look at things on a historical matter, but with the stock at all-time high, we're talking about the all-time highest highs of the stock market. And if we come off 10 or 15%, who cares?
Right.
It should. Like, that's not a point of panic. That's what should happen. So if people assume that that's the point when we should do something, it can get way worse, or should get way worse, I think, before they should clamor for the Fed to do anything. So if anything, the Fed should just do nothing at that point instead of raising rates. Or, I don't know. It's like, this isn't my area of expertise. This is not, you're trying to get me riled up on something that I...
Well, no, I'm just trying to shoot the shit with you. But I think you make a good point. When you look at historical interest rates, I mean, they've never been lower for longer. And the last time they, you know, came down and were low on a relative basis for this long, then, you know, it was followed by interest rates going to 15% or 11% or whatever Volcker brought right. them to. So I think a situation like that's inevitable again. To me, it only makes sense.
So I had one, I think, good thought about my bad day in speech that I didn't get out earlier, is that there's a mechanism that you say in your head when you're having a bad trade, when you say my trade should be doing something, and as soon as you say your trade should be doing something that it's not doing, you're basically admitting that your trade's wrong, and you know it, and that's another time to just get out and move on.
Yeah, that's like a
clear your head.
It's a legit piece of wisdom that makes a lot of sense when you put it like that. So real quick, tell
the title.
Oh, go ahead.
The title of my speech was "Hope and Hubris is a Shitty Trading Strategy, but a Damn Good Bar Name."
Yeah, and
so that's all I got.
I apologize for not seeing your presentation. I felt bad about it, and as you know, that morning was rough for me as well because I wound up having to go on before I thought I was going to have to go on, and I like to write my presentation 15 minutes before I go on. So I got on stage with no clue what I was going to talk about, and it went downhill from there. It wasn't good, Ryan.
I told you, I wrote my note, the Fed is bad.
Yeah. I took a photo of that, I think, and put it on Twitter. All right, man. Well, listen, will you come back on, you know, some point over the next couple of months? I don't want to wait 9 months again, but let's have you back on, talk about the markets maybe 2-3 months again.
Yeah, definitely, man. Let me know.
And if you want to tell the listeners what you guys do at Open Outcrier.
Okay, so we focus on breaking news and options trades. We post things as fast as anybody I know, and we do it all on our website, www.openoutcrier.com. Our main two trades are unusual options and news flow. So we're looking for something that the market doesn't know. I want to find a violent move in a stock, and I want to take the options for a little ride, and that's exactly what we post about. Everyone can get a free two-week trial. Come check us out, and if not, just reach out to me on Twitter. Ask any questions. I always respond.
All right. Awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, the one, the only, Ryan Sellers. Thank you, brother. I will speak to you soon.
All right. Thanks, Chris.
All right. Take care, buddy. That was the one, the only, Ryan Sellers from OpenOutcrier.com. Good buddy of mine. Felt like I talked over him for a large portion of the podcast, but what are you going to do? We'll have him back on, and we'll let him ramble on for an hour. Anyways, I got shit I got to do. It is Saturday. I hope everybody is sincerely having a fantastic weekend, but for now, I am out. Peace.